Welcome to Threads of Healing, conversations with the wayward and the wise. This is your host, Dr. Ila Manga, coming to you from Johannesburg, South Africa. Threads of Healing is the space for exploring what healing could mean by having deep conversations with wisdom keepers, doctors, artists, storytellers, fact finders, and visionaries. We bring awareness to the voices who have answered their call to heal and to discover a new way of living, breathing, and being in the world, and will inspire you to do the same. So today we are having a conversation with someone who is a very special part of my life. I've been keeping her to myself for way too long, and today it feels like I'm sharing her with you, because I really believe the world would be a better place by knowing her. So Annie Snyman is a highly accomplished South African artist, poet, and environmentalist who works deeply with the poetry of land and in collaboration with nature to offer moments of pause, presence, and healing to all those who engage with her creations. Many of her large-scale nature installations and earth drawings can even be seen from Google Earth. For the past few years, I have had the profound privilege of spending every Monday afternoon and every Wednesday morning in Annie's company, painting with her, walking with her, sharing ideas, insights, books. And it's just really a profound privilege to have her in the studio with me today. So, Annie, welcome to Threads of Healing.
Thank you, Ila. I'm very honored to be here with you and listening to all your previous conversations. It's a real honor to be here.
So, Annie, I knew that I had met a kindred spirit when I came across a piece of your work that you collaborated with a friend, Eugenie Kroblar, called Disobedience Training.
That was a fantastic time of our lives. It was around 2007, 2008 that those conversations started. We were deeply concerned about the environmental situation, and also so concerned about our complicitness in this situation. I mean, you can't avoid ruining something all the time. You drive, you eat, you wear clothes that are made in ways that shouldn't be, you know. Mm-hmm. So it's the complicit structure of being, even in your awareness, that you are always obedient to this culture that is so destructive. So that led to us thinking, well, why? How does one become disobedient? But then it was more complex than that, because just rebelling against something just sends you into the other end of the spectrum, and then you do exactly the same things.
In a different way.
Absolutely. Well, even in the same way. You know, violence begets violence, and if you're violent again against another human being, they're also animals. So it's the... You cannot actually just rebel, because rebellion is also obedience to the system. Specifically, our culture is incredibly violent, and it breeds more and more violence in itself and thereby perpetuates itself. So it was a very deep question to figure out, how does one become disobedient? And then we eventually created a little workshop that we called Disobedience Training, you know, and we had...
I want to come to that.
It's not nearly as much fun as you might think. So,
what did it involve?
Well, we basically got friends together and said, let's try and think this out together. And one of the first things that we realized was that somewhere between the obedience and rebellion, you know, so if you say that the two sides are the East and the West, you have a place where they come together again, And right in that middle, or on the very further side, when the one changes into the other, in that paradox, you're as close to the truth as you're ever going to get. So then we said, how do you stay? How do you stay in that dead zone? And the word dead zone came from the place in Berlin, where between the east and the west of Berlin, they had about 100 meter wide piece between the walls, where no human beings were allowed for about 30 years. And the nature just flourished there. Foxes, deer, snakes, everything came back in the middle of the city. And now the dead zone in Berlin is the green zone, the life zone. So we thought, how do we create that dead zone in ourselves? How do you become present? So that's actually the disobedience journey. Is looking for the paradox.
Wow. And so, in that process, I guess one has to visit both sides of the polarity in order to kind of really drop into that moment. Does it require that one visits both ends of the spectrum of the duality?
We worked out this little system that's very useful in creativity. And it is looking for your symptom. So if you have if you are triggered by something, or if you're worried about something, or if you have found yourself making the same mistake often, mm-hmm. is to look for your symptom. Where in your body is this located? You know, so if you're very angry or very scared, or there's somewhere in your body that specific symptom is located.
Right.
It lives there. And then you try and be with that. You stay with your symptom until you can find its opposite within you as well. So it's really a very intense slowing down process. And of course then after 14 years we realized, no, the Buddhists have gotten this a long time ago, but we had to find it out our own way.
But isn't that just a profound process of healing? Is that, you know, we can read all the texts in the world, all the self-help books in the world, but true healing happens when we own it for ourselves and we commit to that process. And, you know, it's a slow kind of personal uncovering of the layers of who we are.
I think so. It's good to live with the not knowing in yourself, you know, to live with it and not to just accept holy scriptures and other people's words for things. You do need to feel it in yourself. Otherwise, why are you on this journey? You know.
And I feel that your work, your art, is really a deep exploration of what you have just spoken about now, that it's not just about lights and harp music and equanimity, that to arrive at this place that is beyond duality, that one has to visit the cycle of birth and death.
I think it's good creative discipline and good life discipline not to try and shy away from the dark places and the low places. That's where the potential lies. That's where water flows to. It's the uncomfortable things are the things that will give you new insights. The comfortable things tend to blind us. And one thing you said just now is that you arrive at this place beyond duality. And one of our language problems is that we always have a static word for a thing.
And destination point.
Destination point, yes. And I think it's more of a flow. It's always a flow. It's always a transformation. It's a changing, it's a falling. It's not a place.
Yes.
It's a motion. It's a verb.
Wow, that's beautiful. And that this is constantly in process, as absolutely. Nature is.
Yes, absolutely. Well, the whole thing, if you slow yourself down enough, if you try and be present in the moment is changing all the time. You know, it's as if the moment is the crucible of transformation.
Why do you think it is that human beings are so averse to feeling discomfort?
Well, it's scary, it's painful, it's all the reasons why we are. I think we can avoid it. It's the because we experience life in the two opposites, or we at least describe it to ourselves in opposites. We always need to know what is the opposite of what I'm feeling, or what I'm thinking, or what because that's the way we describe things. It's language, and it's also perceptions. You know, you can't, in a grey room with everything grey, you can't see anything. You need contrast. But we have forgotten that we need both. You know, you can't actually see the light if there's no darkness, and you can't experience the stillness if there's no noise. You know, so I think it's just that we think we can avoid it, which is like this COVID epidemic. The epidemic itself, I think, is not nearly as serious as the culture's reaction to it. That is pretending that this is a surprise that some of us die, and trying to avoid it, actively trying to avoid it and making it like this is a terrible thing. And it is the way that life sustains itself is through death. So I'm really concerned about our cultural not a blind spot, it's like a impenetrable sunglasses, you know.
Yeah, it's like the collective reaction to this pandemic is a reflection of how we as individuals work with our own shadow, work with our own pain, work with our own resistance to suffering, work with our own, or not work with our own kind of fear of death.
Yes.
You know, and it's almost it is a primal fear, but in really confronting it, in accepting the inevitability of it, there's a kind of freedom, there's a kind of expansion that happens in just dropping into that ultimate fear.
For sure. And it... maybe because it's a primal fear, that little bit of expansion, freedom, acceleration happens every time. You almost don't get tired of it, of saying, well, maybe today I will, you know, face this final. So I think it makes you more alive.
Because it can be seen as the opposite, something that's quite morbid, and you know. But in fact, as you were saying, when we can really, really drop into the not knowing, into the depth of that, into the darkness of that, that offers the profound opportunity to touch something, to open to something.
Yes, and to. I think that's where gratitude lies, you know, to actually experience this incredible gift. Mm. Yeah.
Mm. You know, what is really a profound experience for me was being in the studio with you for the last few months on a Monday afternoon and watching the creation and destruction process of your work of art, your current work that you call a shroud. And that for weeks you would work on portraits, you would work on a particular image and a flow of images, that felt complete, and in the next moment you would paint over it.
Yes. The shroud, I was trying in this wonderful opportunity of COVID lockdown when there were almost no interruptions to immerse myself in the transformational energy of everything and to try and follow and give visual expression to that energy that is always feeding on itself and it has no qualms about destruction because it just uses the old bit for the new part, you know. It is not and it is not a it's not an evil, hateful destruction. It's actually quite loving, which was a good experience.
Was it something that you consciously had to work with within yourself?
I don't know. You know, with painting, you do it. There's a conscious part, and then there's a very part, huge surprise in it that you had no idea that you could do that, or it's the paint doing it, or, yeah. You know, you don't know where it comes from.
Yes. So really, it's an experience of getting oneself out of the way, or allowing oneself just to get out of the way.
Definitely. And so to me, the lovely thing about any art form, whether it's poetry or writing or painting, is that you can step back and almost see your sequence of presences and understand what has happened. You know, if you do things that have not got a record in them, you don't know where you've been, and you get to the same place again and again, and you don't actually know that you're not on exactly the same level. But when you paint, or when you do art for years, you find that you get to the same point again, but you are lower or higher on the spiral. It's like a spiral.
And really, that creativity or the creative process is a healing act, and I see so many parallels in the healing process and in the creative process, and in fact it's the same thing.
That's amazing to me. I mean, I'm watching you and listening to you around your process of thinking through issues in the medical culture that is much older, but at least 2,000 years of written and recorded collective work. I mean, to me, that is the most amazing thing about medicine, modern Western medicine. But then there's also all these other systems that are just as old, or older some, and how you are bringing things together and interacting really creatively with this incredible, I don't know what to call it, a treasure chest of knowledge, you know, but you are dealing with it in a vibrant way.
And whether it's a healing process, a creative process, they both involve a respect of the cycles of creation and destruction, of the doing and the undoing.
Definitely. There's, one of my favorite artists is Louise Bourgeois. She worked until she was almost 90. She died recently. But one of her artworks in the Tate Modern was I Do, I Undo, I Redo. These three huge towers, steel towers that you could climb into and out of, and with works inside and outside. And I just, that is exactly what it is, that I do kind of this commitment like marriage, and I undo and I redo, you know. To me, that is kind of, that is the point, is you commit to this thing again and again and again.
And it can be a really uncomfortable process. It's not always easy, the undoing.
No, definitely not. We have to renew. You have to undo yourself, undo your old identities, you know.
Yeah, ideas of who you are and roles, and you know that we spend so much time building up, developing, arriving to working for, even.
Yeah, no, and then when you think you've arrived, then you know, oh hell, I'm gonna go. I'm definitely gonna fall any second now.
Yeah, and it speaks to what you were saying about this, you know, this kind of destination drive, this addiction towards arriving at a destination, a point, a moment in time that, you know, you feel you've arrived, and so we spend our whole lives kind of driving ourselves towards that place, and then you realize, oh, okay, this is not real, or this is not what I thought it was, or this is actually not what I want. And so that process begins of undoing, of dying. And sometimes it arrives in a way that is just so shocking and so traumatic.
Definitely. I think a lot of our problems in our society is that people have a lot of shoulds in their lives. They think that bad things shouldn't happen. But it's impossible not to. My son made me read this book, Jerusalem, a biography. I'm not through it yet. Oh, it's terrible. It's just one slaughter upon another slaughter upon another genocide from many sides. There are lots of cultures that actually convene in Jerusalem. And my son is a history nut. So he just told me to, Mom, just try. You know, he was doing this Yoda thing on me. So, and I, for many years, for about, 26 years since he was born, I've been avoiding the news. I'm the most ignorant person you can find in Johannesburg. I know nothing. I cannot even recognize Kim Kardashian on TV. So,
you're not alone.
Oh, excellent. And the main reason why I avoid the news is because I feel it, you know, and I can't deal with all this trauma. So now I have to read 4,000 years of trauma in Jerusalem, the biography. So, and I always thought that it would I would crumble under this, all this injustice and suffering and stuff. And despise humanity even more than I used to because of where we are. And strangely enough, this book is actually by forcing me to actually look at it. I am finding myself more empathetic towards humanity.
Wow. But isn't that the whole point of visiting suffering? Isn't that the whole kind of gift of empathy, of going there, of visiting the darkness within ourselves and looking at the darkness around us?
It seems to be. And then, you know, you spend so many years thinking that this is what you're doing, and then suddenly you realize, but you haven't quite been doing that, you know.
Yeah.
So we all avoid things. And we don't, sometimes you know you're avoiding something, but you have to face it at some time. Some stage, because otherwise you are not complete.
What do you think we need in order to feel more safe to visit that which is so terrifying for us to visit?
Wow. To feel more safe. That's a great question, because
yes.
You do need a holding space generally. I've been very fortunate in my life to always have a holding space, someone, something, someone that believes in what I'm doing, and you can never do well art. You can never do without that holding space. We have a big myth around the artist as being this loner. But you will always find that artists have people that support them and people that they speak to, people that have critical input and inspirational connections. So I think the point is that you need relations. I think we, again, it's a web of motion, of flow. It's not a stationary place. It's where it's like the eddy in a stream, where you have the silence, but you are still connected. You're always connected. Yes.
I feel that that's the gift that you have offered me in my own process of making sense of things, my growth. You've offered a space of connection, but also presence. You know, just walking with you, seeing the world through your eyes has supported me in becoming so much more present and engaging with your art, engaging with my kind of playful messing around with art. It's really profoundly shifted the way I'm seeing myself in the world.
Well, I'm glad, because you've done the same for me.
Yeah. But it's this connection that you're speaking about, the holding space. And I think that's so important, is to choose those connections, to create that container for ourselves, to accept the support that is around us, the connections, and even with nature.
Definitely. To me, we're so human-focused that's sometimes what makes us so feel so isolated. But anything can be your connection. Rock? Anything.
Speaking of rocks, tell us about your latest installation.
In Hermanus?
Yes, the rock shroud.
Well, I have to just make this little caveat. It's not just mine. It's always myself, my brother, and lots of volunteers that call themselves, we call ourselves the site-specific land art or nature art collective. We've been engraving a rock in Hermanus on the cliffs, at Gearing's Point, a place called Kombuis, which means kitchen. And I don't know if you know, but Hermanus used to be a whaling point, mm-hmm. a whaling station. So I presume that they were doing a lot of the processing of the whale carcass at this point. And therefore, over the last 100 years or so, especially the seagulls have become used to food there at that place. But obviously now, last 50 years or so, this has not happened. But it's a beautiful, beautiful view over the ocean. And there are dassies that live there, and seagulls, and lizards, and mossies, and Kransdiver. Rock pigeons. Rock pigeons, yes. So, 4 years ago, we found a rock. They were being excavated a couple of blocks away from this point. Mm-hmm. They were doing a new development. So we took this rock, probably a ton or so, a very nice crane operator took the rock for us, and from the excavation and all the way down the road into this touristy place and plonked it down. And then we engraved a dassi on it. And we filled the holes, the engraving line, with ball bearings that then rusted. So 4 years later, the Fine Arts Committee asked us to come and work on it again. So we added a seagull and a lizard and a pigeon and a mossy to the rock. And it's been, and also a basin. That when it rains, it fills with water. And the daddies came and looked at what we were doing, and the seagulls came to drink water. It was as if they knew that we were making this artwork for them. It was lovely.
But you also covered it with a shroud.
Yes, the shroud that we spoke about earlier that you saw the making and unmaking of. Which now I've cut that shroud that was about 6 by 5 meters into 3 parts, and now I'm working on 3 different shrouds from that one.
Why shroud?
I think we need to look at our death rituals and the way we process our dead bodies. I read somewhere that a human being is the only species on earth that hoards its dead. You know, we keep our dead people around, we bury them together. Yeah, it is a bit strange. But I've always been interested environmentally in water. And what I've realized lately is that burial, especially when we have so many endemic illnesses and medications in our bodies, that burial is not a good practice for the groundwater, because obviously the graves get wet and the water seeps through the bodies, and then it poisons the groundwater.
Wow, so we're even complicit when we're dying.
Yes. And obviously the same can be said about air in terms of, and energy in terms of, cremations. So our cultures need adjustment. And as artists, I feel we have a role to play in creating culture. So I'm hoping that we can shift back into a more part of the cycle way of disposing of our dead. Probably, most probably not in my lifetime, but you know, you sow the seed. I know that in Namibia, the Nama people are still allowed to leave their dead in the open veld for scavengers to come and eat. And obviously in Tibet, the sky burial is still a thing. It's just that as a species, we eat more than anyone else on the planet. And we refuse to give that back to the cycle of life. I'm always sounding like the Lion King here. But we need to return ourselves to give back the gift.
Wow. So Annie, we've been speaking so much about death as... we've been speaking so much about death and the acceptance of death as part of the healing process, the creative process. It's something that I have been personally working with, you know, in my own life, just really going there, even taking myself consciously to the moment of my last breath, because I feel that there's something there. It offers an opening to a deeper understanding of myself, of life. And so working with you in the space of, you know, creating the shroud, and you working with the same thing in a different way, we've been having a real conversation about this. And so it's led to this idea of doing this exhibition, right?
Yes. I'm very excited about the thought. It's much more than an exhibition. From my perspective, obviously, there are the shrouds that I'm seeing as hopefully beautiful, evocative objects that would lead to a culture where people can have family shrouds instead of caskets, you know, killing a tree for every person, and that there could be beautiful rituals around leaving your person in a portal of sorts where your person can be returned to the wild and to nature. But what is exciting to me about the exhibition, that, for lack of a better word at the moment, that you and I have been imagining, would be where there could be meditations and breathing workshops into thinking about death, thinking, understanding, and going towards your own mortality, to feel it, to understand through that your vitality, you know, to make it a cultural event, yeah. Is more what you and I have been talking, yeah, about.
And also a healing journey, because especially at this time, there have been so many rituals that haven't happened because of the pandemic.
Oh, yes.
You know, funeral rites that haven't happened because people were unable to gather, unable to, you know, really create the funeral services that are really important.
Yes, and death for us is very closely linked to most religions and also to our sense of sacredness. So sacred spaces are very often linked to burial rites and ancestral grounds. So just as an environmentalist, I had this little crazy idea that if you buried or left enough dead people in a wild place, human beings will leave it alone because they will be scared, you know. So they, or at least have a sense of sacredness. So it's both a profoundly deep investigation and also quite funny at times, because human beings are funny. We're weird.
Oh yeah, and wayward.
Yes.
And deeply wise too. And
Not sure about that one, but I'm definitely working towards seeing the wisdom in my fellow human beings, you know, as much as possible. And it's always, it's one of those things you can always see in someone else.
Well, I am deeply honored to have your waywardness and wisdom in my life. And thank you. And I'm sure that everyone who's listening out there is feeling as inspired as I do every time I'm in your presence. Thank you, Annie. Thank you for listening to Threads of Healing, the podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ila Manga. If you haven't subscribed yet, please do so on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And feel free to leave a review and tell us what you think. If you have found this podcast inspiring and useful, and you know someone who would too, please feel free to pass this along.